From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, House of Sand and Fog, we'll talk with André Debuse III. His best-selling novel about two families laying claim to the same house is now a movie starring Ben Kingsley and Jennifer Connelly. Also, we meet Sir Ian McKellen, one of Britain's most acclaimed actors. McKellen stars in all three Lord of the Rings films, including the latest, Return of the King. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced separately tonight that Libya has agreed to give up weapons of mass destruction and invite in international inspectors. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
President Bush described it as a major step in the effort to stop the spread of weapons of mass destruction and part of his war on terrorism.
Libya has begun the process of rejoining the community of nations. And Colonel Gaddafi knows the way forward.
Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi has been trying to rid himself of pariah status and get out from under U.S. sanctions. He was long suspected of having a chemical weapons program and is on the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism. Earlier this year, his government reached a settlement with victims of the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. President Bush said for the past 9 months, Gaddafi's envoys have been providing U.S. and British officials with details about Libya's weapons programs. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Department of Homeland Security says it's getting a lot of intelligence suggesting possible attacks on U.S. interests abroad and at home. But officials say unless something specific comes in, they will not raise the nation's terror alert level. Officials are urging law enforcement agencies nationwide, though, to be extra vigilant in securing their regions during the holidays. The government's warning comes as a 10-minute audio tape said to contain the voice of al-Qaeda's second-in-command has surfaced. The Arabic satellite channel Al Jazeera played parts of the recording today, in which the speaker, alleged to be Amin al-Zawahiri, threatens the U.S. and its allies. The speaker calls the attacks against U.S.-led forces in Iraq a holy war of the Iraqi people. The CIA says it's still trying to determine if the tape's authentic. The World Health Organization is asking governments around the globe to track down laboratory samples of the SARS virus and to destroy unneeded stocks as a precaution. NPR's Richard Knox has more.
The WHO says research laboratories represent the greatest threat for a new SARS outbreak. The agency says a large number of labs currently hold stocks of the dangerous virus. The WHO is trying to crack down on SARS lab safety in the wake of an accident in Taiwan earlier this month in which a 44-year-old military researcher got infected with the virus. There was a similar accident last September in Singapore. Some new facts about the Taiwan incident are emerging. A Taiwanese investigator says the researcher probably got infected by handling a leaky trash bag. That raises questions about whether the top security lab was properly disposing of the virus-contaminated material. The researcher's father told a TV interviewer that his son delayed reporting his exposure because he was ashamed. Richard Knox, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 30 to settle at 10,278. This is NPR News. NATO has formally authorized the expansion of its peacekeeping mission in Afghanistan outside of the capital, Kabul. Douglas Bakshin reports from Luxembourg City.
The mission is being extended to the northern city of Kunduz, where German troops are already stationed. A NATO statement said the German forces, which will build up to 450 troops early next year, will come under NATO command by December 31st. NATO says the Kunduz expansion is the first step of a plan that will include other provincial cities in Afghanistan. The Afghan government and the United Nations have appealed for the expansion to improve security in the war-ravaged country. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan just yesterday called for governments to contribute troops to an expanded international force, saying that without security, you cannot have reconstruction in the country. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Baxton in Luxembourg City.
The penalty phase of Lee Boyd Malvo's murder trial resumes Monday with the defense fighting for its client's life. 18-year-old Malvo was convicted yesterday on 2 counts of capital murder. Today, the prosecution presented emotional testimony from victims' families. The daughter of Linda Franklin said her mother had been looking forward to the birth of her grandchild. A federal appeals court has dealt a blow to recording industry efforts to crack down on music piracy. Today, a 3-judge panel ruled internet providers cannot be forced to identify subscribers who exchange music online. The panel from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia overturned a trial judge's decision to enforce copyright subpoenas the recording industry used. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, reminding listeners that more than 31 million Americans are at risk of hunger every day. On the web at helpstophunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. The new film House of Sand and Fog is based on the novel by Andre Debuse III. He's been described as a remarkable and distinctive writer who is the son of a remarkable and distinctive writer. His novel House of Sand and Fog was published in 1999. Sadly, the publication coincided with the sudden death of his father, Andre Debuse, of a heart attack at the age of 62. As you may know, Debuse Sr. was an award-winning writer who had lost one leg and lost all use of the other in a freak car accident in 1986. The 2001 film In the Bedroom was based on one of his stories. In 1999, Terry invited Andre Debuse III to talk with us about his novel and to share some memories of his father. House of Sand and Fog is about two people from two cultures who lay claim to the same house, which is about all they possess. Kathy is a house cleaner and recovering drug addict who inherited her father's home, which she loses by not paying back taxes that she was charged mistakenly. By the time the error is corrected, Kathy has been evicted and her home has been sold to an Iranian, a former colonel in the Shah's army. In the movie, he's played by Ben Kingsley. Jennifer Connelly plays Kathy. For the colonel, the home represents his chance for regaining the dignity he feels he and his family have lost as struggling immigrants. The colonel is ashamed to be working on a highway cleanup crew and at a convenience store. This passage from the novel will give you a sense of how he sees America. The colonel is sitting on a bench watching people pass by.
I hear the speech of Orientals, Greeks, Germans, and French. But the majority are the more large, more fed, pink-in-the-face Americans who carry their shopping bags, eating ice cream cones, or drinking sweet sodas from cups as they walk past their small, loud children leading them. I sit and I regard these cows, these radishes, and I again think to myself, these people do not deserve what they have. When I first came to these United States, I expected to see more of the caliber of men I met in my business dealings in Tehran. The disciplined gentlemen of the American military, the usually fit and well-dressed executives of the defense industry, their wives who were perfect hostesses in our most lavish homes. And of course, the films and television programs imported from here showed to us only successful people. They were all attractive to the eye. They dressed in the latest fashion. They drove new automobiles and were forever behaving like ladies and gentlemen, even when sinning against their God. But I was quite mistaken, and this became to me clear in only 1 week of driving my family up and down this West Coast. Yes, there is more wealth here than anywhere in the world. Every market has all items well stocked at all times. And there is Beverly Hills and more places like it. But so many of the people live in homes not much more colorful than airbase housing. Furthermore, those late nights I have driven back to the Pooldar apartment in Berkeley after working, I have seen in the windows of the pale blue glow of at least one television in every home. And I am told that many family meals are eaten in front of that screen as well. And perhaps this explains the face of Americans, the eyes that never appear satisfied, at peace with their work or the day God has given them. These people have the eyes of very small children who are forever looking for the next source of distraction, entertainment, or a sweet taste in the mouth. And it is no longer to me a surprise that it is the recent immigrants who excel in this land, the Orientals, the Greeks, and yes, the Persians. We know rich opportunity when we see it.
I'm wondering how you came up with the way that the colonel sees Americans.
Well, Terry, I guess I can answer that most honestly by talking a little bit about my writing process. For me, it's really, I think the whole reason I do it is because I don't know what I'm doing. And I feel my imagination is pulled to a situation or to a sliver of an image or to a character. And I really write it to find out. And so I based the Colonel situation on a man I knew. He was the father of a friend of mine in, from college. And he was a colonel in the Shah's Air Force, and his life did fall apart after leaving that corrupt regime. And I had an image in my head. I was visiting him, and I saw him working two jobs and disguising what he was doing, hiding that really from people in the building where he lived. And I was, you know, I was struck by it, and it never left. For 15 years, that image of his sort of sallow-faced body in the elevator with groceries at the end of a 16-hour day stuck with me, and I've never been able to let go of it.
But when you said that you watched him disguise what he was doing, the character in your book does a lot of manual labor, but he dresses in a very expensive fine suit to leave the house so people will think he's got a fine job, and then he changes in a hotel or in a restroom along the way to work and puts on his working clothes.
Yeah, I lifted that right from life. But it should be said that the man who I based this on is not remotely like that, and I discovered a whole new character. But yeah, you know, the writer Alice Munro calls those sorts of moments starter dough. that we then bake with all these other ingredients in there and see what comes out.
Well, you know, the colonel in the passage that you just read sees Americans as cows who just take for granted the good things that they have and, you know, live kind of slothful lives and don't appreciate the important values. And I wonder what, if anything, you share with his point of view.
Well, I don't share that view. Is that the honest thing to say? This is a way to answer it. I once read something by Alexander Solzhenitsyn that never left my mind about how we Westerners are lacking in the kind of character that those who've lived under communism and totalitarian regime are spared. I mean, they're spared this lack of character, that basically our lives are so easy, we've really been infantilized, if that's a word. We've been made children, and we're lacking the sort of, character that people in tougher situations have. You know, there's a really wonderful essay I teach in my writing classes from the writer Flannery O'Connor called The Nature and Aim of Fiction. And in it, she says so many brilliant things in this essay, but one of the things she said is that our beliefs are not what we see, talking about we writers, but the light by which we see. So that's a real mysterious terrain, and I don't know where it all leads for me. But I do believe that there might be something of my own view in there, although it's a lot harsher and more severe and really clearer for the colonel than for me.
What inspired the idea of two people who have claim to the same place, the same house, who both desperately need it?
Well, you know, I know a lot of writers share this little technique I have. I get a lot of good story ideas from newspapers, especially the, you know, your local or national news briefs, where they just have a really scant little paragraph that presents the situation but gives you no detail. So your imagination really gets hungry for the detail. And my first writing class I ever taught was in 1990 at Emerson College, and I had never taken a writing class, and I didn't know how to teach one. So I'll get them started the way I start. So I brought in a newspaper and pointed to some news sections, and one of them was about a woman in Oakland who had her house evicted for failure to pay back taxes she did not owe. And when they admitted their mistake, the county who had evicted her, they had already sold it, and now the men who bought it legally didn't have to give it back. That was actually in the newspaper clipping, and I told my students, one of you guys should write about this. This is pretty interesting. And nobody did, but it never left my imagination either. But after finishing my second book 3 years later, I started to write myself into that. But it didn't come together, Terry, until I had been trying to write about the colonel situation for years, too, and I thought, well, maybe it'll just be a poem about a guy in an elevator. I mean, maybe it'll be a short essay. I don't know what it'll be. It doesn't seem to be a wannabe fiction. But then I actually noticed in the newspaper clipping that I had kept that the man who bought the house had a Middle Eastern name. And while I think it was probably Arabic and not Iranian, it did get me, the old little, you know, the writer light bulb went off, and I thought, well, what if my colonel bought that house? And then it took off, and, you know, 4 years later, it was done.
The the point of view in your novel keeps shifting between the colonel and Kathy. And so you're writing in each of their first-person voices. Mm. And this requires you writing in the character of two people who are very different from you, and you're doing this at a time when some people get very angry if they think a writer is presuming that he or she is capable of understanding someone who is of a different race or ethnic group or gender.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if...
I'm so glad you're bringing this up.
I'm wondering if you feel that this is a loaded time to be writing in the voices of an Iranian colonel and a woman.
Especially when I'm a white guy?
Yeah, right.
I think, yes.
That's what usually goes, right? That white guys aren't allowed to do this. Yeah.
I know, and I completely... I think I understand the intent behind the anger behind all of this. And while I completely am with that anger, and we're looking at, you know, thousands of years of patriarchy and imperialism and genocide, that's what's actually caused this anger, and I'm no small audience. I mean, I listen to that and share in that rage, actually. But the fact is, I think culturally we are deeply misled when we begin to go after writers who are doing this. The fact of the matter is, it is our job. It's not just an interesting thing to do. It's the very job description of the writer, is to imagine the lives of others. And I think the writer Rose Ellen Brown really put this all to rest for me. She articulated it really well, I think. She said that, you know, when the writer puts him or herself in the shoes of the other, you know, for instance, a white male, right, from the point of view of a dark-skinned man or a woman, etc., that far from it's, this is not an act of colonialism. Actually, because it's an act of empathy, it's inherently an act of friendship. Now, the danger, of course, is that the writer can fall flat on his or her face and get it completely wrong. And I think that's where the risk should lie. I mean, we should be able to take that risk, and we should, you know, oftentimes we fail. But nothing risked, nothing gained. I truly believe that the imagination is huge. And if I get on my little high horse for a second, I do think that we live in a time that's suspicious of the imagination. I mean, I think that's why TV talk shows are so big, and I think that's why memoirs are so big, and I think that's why true life crime shows are so big. I don't know what's going on, but somehow we don't trust the imaginative work as much as we did even 20 years ago when I was in college.
You teach. Do you find that to be true with students also?
Mm-hmm. I do, especially, well, younger ones, those 18, 19, 20 years old, who, you know, are wonderful young people. You know, there's all sorts of hope for the future from my little vantage point in classrooms every semester. But I do think that we have been shaped by that tube in all of our homes. And I think maybe that did come out in the Iranian's point of view. But that television, I think, has done a number on us in ways that I can't even put my finger on yet. But there is this impatience with, I'm seeing with 19-year-olds who I teach, to get to the heart of it, to get to it. And it isn't necessarily an imaginal textual experience so much as give me the facts, give me the numbers, give me the bottom line, give me the it. And it's kind of a drive-through. drive-by way of looking at it.
The express line.
Yeah, you know, and you know, they're products of this time, but and they're wonderful young people. But it is different from just when I was in school in the late 70s. I feel a real difference.
In understanding the lives of your characters, does it help that you've done a lot of different things so far in the course of your life? You've held, for instance, a lot of different jobs, from house cleaning to bounty hunter.
Weird, huh? Yeah, that bounty hunter thing was a one-weekend job. Throughout my 20s, I roamed. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I got a degree in general liberal arts and then just fled and just roamed the country. And I began to write early on, and I had a hunch that was part of what I was going to be doing. But I was also interested in acting, and I just felt this vague sort of passionate need to experience. And I don't think I kept a job more than 6 months, which is why I did so many things in the course of about 8 or 9 years. But yeah, to answer your question, I think it's absolutely helped. I did go to Mexico to look for a killer, you know, for some law enforcement agencies. But, you know, I was 22 and I think just chasing adventure. But again, if I can quote Flannery O'Connor, whose work I really admire, and this essay I teach all the time, she says that the job of the writer is not to be immersed in experience, but to contemplate it, to reflect upon it. And I think that's right on. That the imagination, really, you don't have to leave your backyard to write great things. And so, but it doesn't hurt. The short answer is, it can never hurt. It's good work if you can get it, but you don't. I get nervous when 19, 20, 30-year-old even writers think they have to go to the bar room and you know, get stabbed to have something to write about. No, you don't. No, you don't.
Well, that said, tell me something about that weekend you were a bounty hunter.
Well, I was working with a private investigator. We were working corrections together. I was his assistant, and I was running the show sometimes when we went off on these trips. He's a very interesting guy. He was really a healer, and he would heal people he worked on. So he would turn them into authorities and then do counseling on them and heal them. It was a really fascinating situation. But we were tracking down, I have to stay really vague about this out of safety for myself and my family, but we were tracking down a guy who was very dangerous, and I had a fake name, a pseudonym, and we went to a lot of gay bars in Mexico looking for him. And I was 22 years old and naive, and I got a real eye-opening experience about that subculture and spent a lot of time going to gay bars. I'm trying not to feel self-conscious. I thought I was a young white male, but I was getting so much big manly male attention, it confused me. What is it about me that, you know, people do that? So, for me, it was less frightening in terms of guns and knives and killings, which was all afoot. It was more frightening about all the homosexual stuff. You know, I was 22 and repressed, so. It was an interesting experience and actually very moving because I saw poverty like I'd never seen. You know, I grew up in, you know, some, you know, fairly depressed areas in the Northeast, mill towns. And, you know, I thought I grew up in some tough, well, you know, neighborhoods. And really, they don't even come close to the poverty of, quote unquote, third world places. And that really affected me. I saw some really devastated families, actually.
André Debus III, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. His novel, House of Sand and Fog, has just been made into a movie. We'll continue after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with novelist André Debus III. She spoke with him in 1999, shortly after his father's death.
I was very sorry to hear about the death of your father recently. Had he been sick, or was this just an out-of-the-blue thing?
No, it was just one of those terrible sudden deaths. He, you know, as you know, because you've interviewed him over the years, he was in a wheelchair the last 12 and a half years of his life, and that's not easy on anybody. But, you know, that... Notwithstanding, he was in pretty good physical shape. You know, my brother and his partner had built a really long, straight ramp from his house just in the last few months, and my father did sprints on it in his wheelchair. In the summer, he swam laps in his pool. He shadow boxed and lifted weights. I mean, he took relatively good care of himself. So, you know, he was 62, and we didn't know. It was a shock. He got in the shower and had a heart attack and died.
Now, I understand that in his papers he'd asked that you build his coffin, and you're one of the many things you do is you're a carpenter.
Mm.
What was your reaction when you found that out?
Well, it was not in his will at all. It actually came as my brother and I were busting his chops over, frankly, the last story he'd ever written called Sisters. It's a Western, and in the Western, the hero builds a coffin for a man and digs the grave and does it all in about 3.5 hours. And my father was a master writer, but he'd never worked with his hands. And my brother and I have always done this kind of work. And we really gave him grief for that, because there ain't no way you can build a box that can hold a 200-pound man in 3 hours, let alone with hand tools, and then dig a hole around trees with roots. So we really gave him, you know, a lot of heat for that, and we're having fun doing it out on his deck this past summer. And he said, well, when you build my coffin, you can take all the time you want, and I want it to be straight pine. And then we got into the discussion here, and he said, and I want to be buried on my land. And so that was just, you know, this past summer, and from busting his chops. And so I was on this book tour for this novel when I heard in San Francisco, and all I wanted to do was get back and hug my children and then go find my brother and build the coffin. And we did. We gathered the lumber store, my brother Jeb and me, and we designed it, you know, through tears. And it was a weird, such a stark experience. And then bought the wood, spent about an hour picking it out in the lumber yard where we'd been for years on jobs. Went to his shop, and from about 5 at night to 9 in the morning, we built my dad's coffin out of pine. And it was a beautiful night, though, I have to say. You know, it'd be like on a job. You know, we'd say, come on, what kind of a router is that? What kind of a, you know, a dado is that? Give me your router, let me show you how to do it. And then, there, you know, it'd be this, you know, masculine sparring. And then we'd be hugging each other and crying, and then we'd be ripping a piece of wood on the table saw and laughing and crying. And then there'd be these long moments of stillness and quiet. Over the course of the night, his friends would come by. You know, his longtime agent and friend, Philip Spitzer, and his brother, Michelle, came with their family, and they just came and were there and took some pieces of wood with them when they left. And one of my father's priests came by about 3 in the morning and helped us sand. And some friends came at dawn with beer and sandwiches. We took a break, and when it was finally done, I lay in the coffin and had him shut it so I could feel what it was like. And I was also honestly testing to see if the lid was the right height and there was enough curve to it. And then we dug the grave because we ended up buying a plot of land a half mile from my dad's house. And the farmer who we bought it from said that she hired her hands to dig it by shovel. She didn't have a backhoe. And when we heard that, we said, well, no, we'll be happy to dig it. If anybody's going to be digging this grave by hand, it'll be his sons. And so my brother Jeb and I and our good friend Bill Cantwell, who's like a third son to my father, we dug the grave. And the funny thing is it took 8 hours. So building the coffin with power tools took 2 men about 12 hours, and digging the grave with 3 men took 8 hours. So the veracity of that detail was off in that story.
So you were right to criticize your father.
Yeah, you need to redo that one.
Did he, by the way, redo it?
No, he didn't. He said, no, well, then there was sand near those roots, and he happened to have the tools. You know, he exercised, you know, he was so far along in the craft. He was such a master. He said, hey, screw it. This is called poetic license. I don't know if he said that, but that's essentially what he did. He just put down the big staff and said, poetic license, move on.
Andre Dubuis III, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. His novel, House of Sand and Fog, has just been made into a movie. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From Universal Pictures, presenting Seabiscuit, based on the true story of an American legend, starring Tobey Maguire, Jeff Bridges, and Chris Cooper, available on DVD and video. And by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Broken Music, a memoir by Sting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Andre Dubuis III. His bestseller House of Sand and Fog was an Oprah's Book Club selection. It's now a film starring Ben Kingsley and Jennifer Connelly. Also, Sir Ian McKellen. He plays Gandalf in all 3 Lord of the Rings films. This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley. Let's get back to Terry's 1999 interview with André Dubuis III. His novel House of Sand and Fog has just been made into a movie starring Ben Kingsley and Jennifer Connelly. The publication of that novel coincided with the death of his father, the award-winning writer André Dubuis, of a heart attack at age 62.
Your father had been a Marine, and from what I recall of one of our interviews, that was really important to him and seemed to be an inspiration to him during his period of recovery.
That's true.
Especially early on. And I don't think that's an experience you had, and I'm wondering if you think that that was a fundamental difference as well, if there's anything that you wished you'd had of that Marine experience.
I remember being 19 at the University of Texas and seeing the boys in dress blues and wanting to jump in and do it because I was a real athletic kid and wanted to be tested in that way. At the same time, I was getting political consciousness and knew that Marines had been used, frankly, for corporate gain. Nothing against the Marines. It wasn't their fault. So I was politicized and couldn't just leap in like that. But the fact is, this is not an issue for me with me and the difference between my father and I and our experience. He used to always say that my Marines was my bar fighting. And I have to put that in context because, boy, I can sound like a real blowhard talking about bar fighting and reactionary. But I do think that men in this culture, especially in working class neighborhoods, have to fight like dogs often. And I grew up in that area, and at 15 or 16 began to fight back after not fighting back for years, and fought for a long time. And it became a real problem. I mean, to the point where, I was never a bully, and I never started fights with anyone who didn't deserve to have a fight started. Usually I'd kind of walk into someone who was beating up his girlfriend and punch him. And it was a weird self-destructive 8 or 9 years. But I had my own demons with masculinity. I know that my father has written about this and talked about this at length, that he joined the Marines because he didn't feel masculine enough, and he felt he had to prove something to his father, who I never had the pleasure of knowing. And, I think it was very soon after his own father's death that my father quit the Marines. But see, one thing the old man did for me is never left me feeling that I wasn't a man already. I judge myself as being needing some strengthening, and I need to be more of a man. But I guess the long answer is, I do think what you seem to be asking, Terry, is was there a rite of passage for me? Is that right?
Sure, yeah. And I guess I'm also wondering what the transition was between not fighting back and fighting back.
A terrible event. I just like a lot of kids, I was a new kid in town for years. I think I went to about 14 schools before I got to high school. And, as did my brother and sisters. And that's a hard life for a kid. And a lot of the neighborhoods were tough neighborhoods. And so for years, I just hibernated and hid inside my house. And my brother was beaten up very badly by a military policeman in the street with a whole bunch of people watching one day. And I didn't do anything about it. And something just, I was 15 years old. And my self-hatred got to such a level, I couldn't endure it any longer. I would really rather be stabbed or shot than not fight again. And something really snapped, and I went on a rampage for about 10 years. By rampage, that's not the right word. I began to lift weights and take care of myself and stop eating Twinkies and drinking Coke. And I stopped doing drugs, which I was doing a lot of in the early 70s as a young teen, and cleaned up my act and really started to work on my body, and then worked on self-defense, and was surprised that I actually had boxing ability. And then I sort of set out to exercise that part of my life. And I put myself in situations, usually bar rooms, where there was always an opportunity to prove whether or not I had what I was hoping I had, which is the ability to fight when I was afraid. And which is, I think, at the core of us all the time. I think we're always afraid. I was always afraid. And so, I would wait until some guy hit his wife or pushed a little guy down or was just being inappropriate, then I would step in and say something like, you know, hi, can I have a glass of milk? Something to get him to insult me. And then I would go at it. It's terrible. I mean, but this is 15 years ago, and mm-hmm. It's something I had to do early in my life, and in direct answer to your question about the Marines, I think it was I had to build a little rite of passage. Not little. It was very significant for me mm-hmm. and very frightening. And I had to design one on my own. And the problem is once you learn to break that membrane, that sort of psychic membrane between your fist and somebody's face, it's sort of something you have in the toolbox, which is a dangerous thing to have.
Right.
And it's important to learn, you know, to love actively without using that.
When your father was alive, did you show each other your writing before it was published?
Yes, we did. Absolutely.
And were you honest with each other? You know, it's hard sometimes when you're really close to someone and they give you their work. If there's mm-hmm. something that you don't think works, it could be hard to be honest. Cause,
yeah, you know. It really is hard to be honest. Honestly, there is very little my father gave me of his that I could say anything but, wow, Dad.
Right.
Pretty great. Can I go hide now and curl up in a ball somewhere? They're honestly, out of the 80, 90, I have to count now how many stories he wrote and published. I think it was close to 100 in his lifetime, in his career. There was one little story I didn't like, and I told him right off. And he wrote it on the plane on the way down to a reading, and it read like it to me. And it got up into one of his books, and I said, Dad, that one just doesn't work for me. And but he always told me as well. But after a while, I didn't trust him because he was so effusive about my work. He believed in it so much more than I ever believed in my own. And I thought, oh, and also when I became a father, you know, come on, I want to show people my son's poop. look how cute that little spit is at the corner of his lip. When I became a father, I really stopped believing him. Although I, you know, it's probably unfair to him, but I thought, come on, he loves me. He's not going to tell me this is a contrived piece of crap I have to write over. You know, but we did. We showed each other after. Over the years, I've been defensive because people have assumed with the same name and having my father as a writer that, you know, he helped me. Well, no, he didn't. He helped me afterwards. If I had a draft done, I'd show it to him and show it to my wife and a couple of friends of mine whose opinion I respected, but my agent. But it was always after the fact. And more so for me, just I've always been a fairly private, independent little guy. And, you know, a Virgo. So, you know, I never showed him until I was done.
I think one of the real dilemmas writers have, even fiction writers, is that if they're basing a character on someone who they know and who they're close to, and that person recognizes themselves in the story, that even if that person is transformed a lot in the fiction, that person can still be offended if they feel that they've been mischaracterized or described in a negative way.
Mm.
And I figure since your father was a writer, you might have been very sensitive to that because there might have been characters and stories who were loosely modeled on you, and you might have been sensitive about that yourself. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I was, and I do think it's the obstacle and challenge of so many writers that back to this point about imagination being somehow under siege right now in late 20th century America is, in my opinion, is I think I see that with writers with whom I work who will stop cold in their tracks a perfectly wonderful story because they're afraid of how their dead mother will read it over their shoulder. And that's a completely understandable fear. But I do think that the art has to go past that, and that the truth has to be illuminated in whatever way. And also, as you said, they are transformed. This is no longer your mother. This is no longer your father. You know, you based all those physical features on your living daughter, but because now it is in a work of literature and not life, it is no longer her. This alchemy occurs. My father did a very generous thing when I first began writing and publishing when I was 22. I sold my first story, and he called me. I was in Colorado at the time, and it was just so generous and so loving, and said, listen, you know, you're going to be a writer whether you think you are or not. And frankly, for 10 more years, I wasn't calling myself that, and I didn't think that's where I was going. And he said, just don't do what I did. Don't wait until we're dead before you write about us. He said, feel free to do it now. And I thought that was a really brave and generous, kind thing to say. And I took him up on it. But a year later, I wrote a story about, based on the day when my father left my family in divorce. And there was a scene there with the girl based on my little sister. And in the scene, she cries a little bit. I think I had phrased, she cried a little bit too. My father, after reading the manuscript, said, well, she cried a lot, actually. And when I said to feel free to write about us, I didn't mean to take me up on it right now. But, you know, yeah,
so
that happens.
Was he truly sorry that you'd done it?
No, he was. It just brought up, it was painful for him and painful for me. And but no, he just put it in its place and gave me a hug and said it was a good story and sent it out.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Andre Dubuis III, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. His novel, House of Sand and Fog, has just been made into a movie. Coming up and coming out, Sir Ian McKellen. This is Fresh Air. $34.1 million. That was the opening day box office total for the final installment in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which came to theaters earlier this week.
It's so quiet.
It's the deep breath before the plunge.
I don't want to be in a battle. But waiting on the edge of one I can't escape is even worse. Is there any hope, Gandalf, for Frodo and Sam?
There never was much hope. Just a fool's hope.
Before Ian McKellen donned his robes as Gandalf the Wizard in the Lord of the Rings film trilogy, he was already celebrated, especially in his native England, as one of the most versatile and gifted actors of his generation. Most of McKellen's work has been on the British stage in classical theater. His best-known stage role in America was as Salieri in the original Broadway production of Amadeus. His film work, prior to his role in the blockbuster Lord of the Rings series, consisted mainly of roles in smaller films, such as Scandal and The Band Played On, 6 Degrees of Separation, and Gods and Monsters. 15 years ago, at the age of 49, McKellen publicly came out. It was, in part, a reaction against an English law passed in 1988 prohibiting the publication of materials that promoted homosexuality. McKellen was knighted 3 years after coming out. When Terry spoke with Ian McKellen in 1994, she asked him if he was surprised to be knighted.
Yes, frankly, I was. I think I was the first openly gay person to receive an honor in Britain, and I took that as a slightly hopeful sign that maybe the world was beginning to grow up at last. I was happy to accept it as an actor because it put me, nominally at least, in the company of people I've admired all my life, like Sir Laurence Olivier and Sir John Gielgud and so on. But as an activist, which by that time I was, I knew in class-conscious Britain to be a knight was a very useful handle. And it meant that certain doors would open because I would have some social clout. And so it's proved. And it just means that government ministers, people right up at that level, are much more likely to answer a letter personally if it's on paper which is headed Sir Ian McKellen than one that just comes from that actor, Johnny, who I don't really know who he is. It just changed their attitude subtly, but crucially, I've found.
What were your big fears about coming out, and did any of them come true?
I think what had always been a barrier to my coming out was the sense that no one would cast me, for example, as Romeo if they knew that in my private life it was Mercutio I fancied rather than Juliet. And that is, I know a lot of actors feel that if their audiences were to know that they were gay, somehow it would limit their possibilities of work. That really hasn't proved the case to me, but at 49 I was well established, and in fact I've had more work than ever, particularly in films, playing, as I always have done, heterosexuals as well as homosexuals. So if that was the fear, it was, in my case, an ungrounded one. But the real fear was nothing to do with my career at all. It was, as I've been saying, the great pressure that's put on gays and lesbians, whatever job they do, to keep quiet and shut up and go away and stay tight shut in the closet. And it takes a great deal of will to realize that you're taking on the world by coming out.
Do you think it affected your acting at all to have something very important and very personal that you had to hide from so many people?
It's difficult for me to assess, but critics and friends say that I am a better actor. One of the reasons I became an actor was feeling inhibited about expressing that part of myself, my sexuality, in public and private quite openly. I was able on stage to indulge my passions and be very open about them and draw attention to them. And that's why I think so many lesbians and gay people who are closeted privately are on stage extremely passionate. I suppose, therefore, it might have been that when I reached the stage in which I was open about this very important part of myself, there would be no need for me to be an actor anymore. Personally, and I think actually that is true. I find as much satisfaction from my work as an activist and my getting close to the power structure in the United Kingdom to the extent of being able just to add my weight to changing those laws which discriminate against me and other people. That to me is as rewarding as any performing I've done on a public stage. However, I mustn't stop acting, because it's only actually as a gay actor that I think I can be effective as a gay activist. I don't want to become a full-time politician. And actually, I'm so at ease with myself now, and that is the big advantage of coming out. There is nothing I'm frightened of anymore. That, of course, my acting has got to have improved, and because I'm prepared to go into every corner of my nature and my personality and apply it and put it at the service of whatever fictional character I'm playing.
You grew up in small towns in England, and I believe your first exposure to the theatre was travelling theatre groups. What were they like?
I was a theatre girl long before I was an actor, and long before I intended to be a professional actor. And I was very lucky to see a wide variety of theatre. I saw John Gielgud on tour playing King Lear. I used to go down to Stratford-upon-Avon in the 1950s and see the great actors, Olivier, Charles Laughton, Paul Robeson, Edith Evans, Peggy Ashcroft in Shakespeare. I used to see variety theatre, vaudeville, which was still just standing up in England in the 40s and 50s, and at very close quarters, sometimes backstage. I used to visit these artists of various sorts, whether they were animal acts, conjurers, comedians, singers, and that world of stand-up comic has, I think, affected my interest in doing my own solo show, and some of it is deliberately uses the techniques of those people who perhaps I admire more than any other sort of performer, who can bravely stand on an open stage and entertain 1,000 or 2,000 people for a couple of hours. I think people who do that regularly for a living and for whom most of their material is designed to make an audience laugh must be the most exposing experience a performer can have. And those who bring it off, I think, have my admiration more than any others.
So you had the courage when you were young to go backstage and meet the people who were performing?
Well, I was very lucky. My father knew a man who owned a theatre, and that's how it happened. And so I, at a very early age, I was intrigued with the glamour of that secret which performers have, that they know what goes on backstage, and they create what goes on stage. And when they step out of the darkness into the light, something magical happens, you know, that the henpecked husband suddenly becomes the man of total confidence. The slightly dowdy person dressed up in sequins and a bit of makeup on their face suddenly on stage becomes the most glamorous person in the world. And I wonder now, looking back, whether that didn't appeal to me because I was in a dark world of being gay, and yet on stage I was able to step out into the light on my own terms and attract the audience's attention and approval.
When you came to the classical theater from small towns in England, were there things you had to change about yourself for the theater? Things in either your carriage or your diction?
Yes, it's to me a fascinating study that perhaps one day I should try and formalize into a book or something. But theater acting, any acting, is about disguise, and at the same time, it is about absolute honesty. The characters one plays are not oneself, but they have within them aspects of oneself. And you're only ever going to be convincing as, let's say, Macbeth, if you examine that part of your nature, which is so ambitious that you would be prepared to commit murder for your own self-advancement. You have to be able to imagine what that would be like and therefore look deep, deep into yourself. Now, that is being extremely honest in a way that most people are not required to be honest in their work. And at the same time, you are disguising because you are not Macbeth, nor do you speak in blank verse, which he does. And when I was a young man, I thought as an actor, it would be limiting to be vocally, for instance, identifiable as someone from the north of England. And so I got rid of my northern accent to a great extent and spoke received pronunciation English. And I rather regret I did that because I think probably on the whole there was no need to do it. An actor should have two sort of accents, perhaps, their own, their native one, and then something of a more general nature which they can use where it's applicable. But when I started out acting, I thought all actors should only speak with a bland, received pronunciation.
Sir Ian McKellen speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. He stars as Gandalf in the latest and last Lord of the Rings movie, The Return of the King. We'll continue after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Sir Ian McKellen. She spoke to him in 1994 when he was known primarily for his stage work.
I'd like to talk with you about your acting career. First of all, you really haven't done many movies. Most of your career has been on the stage, mostly the English stage, but some on Broadway as well, and Amadeus, for instance. Has it been a conscious choice to not do movies, or is that something you would have liked to do more of?
Thank you. That's a very kind and discreet way of putting it. I've spent my life trying to get into movies, and and here I am. The trouble is, with acting in the theatre, and it's about the only disadvantage, is that it does cut you off from a great many other things, including a stable family life, I must say. I mean, it's absolutely absorbing, and it's almost a 24-hour job. And long contracts and long runs make it very, very difficult to suddenly at the last minute nip off and do movies, which on the whole are cast at the last minute and you're not given much warning. And the only way to really try and have an established movie career, it seems to me, is to refuse to do the theatre for a spell. And rather late in the day, that's what I decided to do after I'd finished the United States tour of Richard III, when we landed up in Los Angeles. I said, right, that's it. Of late in the theatre, I've been increasingly working in small theatres. I suppose that all began when I did Macbeth for the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1978 in a very small theatre indeed, perhaps 120 people scattered around a circular stage area. And since then, I've realised that that's really how I like to work. And film is an extension, of course, because that's a more intimate form of acting still.
So what are you having to learn doing more movies?
I'm not having to learn in the extent of unlearn bad habits. That's not the point. Acting in the theatre is a question of selecting what you want the audience to receive, because an audience sitting a long way away in the balcony will depend on very clear messages from the stage in gesture and in exaggerated body language and vocal technique. They need to have the character presented to them. I'm more interested in having that relationship where an audience selects for themselves from what is on offer, and that means they have to be very close. They have to be able to see the flicker of the eye. They have to be able to see the thought behind the face and the body, and that means that in front of the camera, I don't select, I just exist, I am, and that is a different technique of acting, though, of course, the process of preparing for it is very much like what you go through when you're rehearsing for a play.
Sir Ian McKellen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sir Ian McKellen, star of the new Lord of the Rings movie, The Return of the King. McKellen was knighted for his stage and film work, which includes on Broadway the role of Salieri in Amadeus. He also appeared in the movies Scandal and The Band Played On, Gods and Monsters, The X-Men, and, a few weeks ago, played himself in cartoon form on The Simpsons. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, presenting the New Voices Film Fest this month, with films by emerging new directors, Saturdays at 9 p.m., listings at sundancechannel.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In Afghanistan, human rights conditions continue to decline. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with John Sifton. He's a lawyer and researcher with Human Rights Watch and has just returned from the region. Join us for the next Fresh Air.